was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Good morning. Welcome on into White Sox Weekly. Saw a penguin and a polar bear as I walked in this morning. And it was not Pete Alonso. But I digress. We do have some former Mets to talk about today because the White Sox made some major news earlier this week, Tuesday evening, when they sent Luis Robert Jr. to the New York Mets in exchange for Luis Angel Acuna and minor league pitcher right-hander Truman Pauly. Now, there's no truth to the rumor that the White Sox could not move one Louis without getting another Louis back in return. That is not what happened here. But what we do know, based on what we heard from Chris Getz, who I will let you hear from in our next segment, but what we do know is that Luis Angel Acuna was critical to why the White Sox made this deal now with the New York Mets. There's no doubt that some of the free agent dominoes that fell this past week certainly, I think, created some more urgency for the New York Mets to make this deal now. I mentioned it at the top of last week's show when Kyle Tucker signed his record-breaking contract in terms of AAV with the Dodgers. All of a sudden, you saw a lot of players then go ahead and make some moves, including the Mets adding Bo Bichette, and then, of course, the Yankees adding Cody Bellinger. And Bellinger's the key here because once I think the Mets learned that they were not going to land Kyle Tucker, they moved on to Bo Bichette. And once they realized that they could add Bo Bichette, they recognized that they were not going to be in the Cody Bellinger market. That's something that was widely reported that both the Mets and Yankees were trying to get Cody Bellinger to sign on the dotted line for their organization. And Cody Bellinger would have been who the Mets would have likely used in center field if they had not been able to land Bo Bichette. Once they did, though, that made it easy for the Mets to pivot and finally meet Chris Getz's asking price for Luis Robert Jr. Now, I think a lot of White Sox fans are disappointed because Luis Robert Jr. is somebody who at his highest highs was, truth be told, an MVP caliber player. Chris Getz mentioned that last spring training. Back in 2023, Luis Robert Jr.'s best season as a member of the White Sox, when he hit 38 home runs and stole 20 bases, he finished 12th in MVP voting. He had a wins above replacement that season of 5.3. And of course, he played gold glove caliber center field. So I think White Sox fans, the book is now closed on his career as a member of the White Sox. He spent 6 seasons with the team. During that period, he accumulated 15.8 wins above replacement. And as I just mentioned, right, he had a 5.3 in his best season in 2023. But in the other 5 seasons with the White Sox, he only accumulated 10.5 wins above replacement. Now, this is a cliche in sports, but your best ability is availability. And I think ultimately that is why the White Sox decided it was time to part ways with Luis Robert Jr. In addition to adding Luis Angel Acuna, Ronald's little brother, they wanted him, of course. And Luis Angel Acuna is loaded with talent. He is extremely athletic. He can play multiple different positions. And the White Sox are very excited about unlocking his potential. Now, you can look at his numbers with the Mets and say, okay, why am I supposed to be impressed by a 23-year-old who hit .234 with a .293 on base and a .274 slug and had 16 stolen bases over 95 games? But the truth is, Acuna with the Mets never had the opportunity to play every day. And I think anybody who has spent any time in baseball will tell you that for a young player who's talented enough to be on the major league roster, but maybe is in a position where they have not been given the opportunity to have every day at bats, it can be an extremely difficult time to be consistent. And I think that's what the White Sox are counting on with Luis Angel Acuña is that they are going to provide the everyday at-bats. It may not always be at the same position, although I wouldn't be surprised if he does acclimate himself in center field quite nicely. What you'll hear from Chris Getz is that Acuña is a plus defender, if not a plus-plus defender, in the infield, and he's not spent a lot of time in the outfield, although he has been spending time this winter in the Venezuelan Winter League, playing shortstop and center field primarily. And, oh yeah, by the way, hitting four home runs in a game about a week and a half ago, something that no player had ever done in Venezuelan Winter League history. So there is a lot to like about Acuña, and that is why the White Sox were happy to finally make this move. In addition to that, the Mets are picking up the full salary for Luis Robert Jr., and something that Chris Getz will discuss when we play it for you here is that the White Sox do have the intention of reinvesting that money into the Major League roster. So we could still be talking about some free agent acquisitions over the next couple of weeks before we actually get to spring training, now that the White Sox have offloaded Luis Robert Jr.'s salary. But again, I think the reason we saw this deal is because ultimately, as Luis Robert Jr. hits his age 28 season, with all the talent in the world, the White Sox are looking for somebody who will be on, who they can count on to be on the field more consistently. And with 5 years of control for Acuña, this is going to be somebody who they hope will grow with the organization and ultimately be a member of the team the next time this team is winning lots of games and competing for playoff competition, which we won't rule out this upcoming season. But I think it's important to note, you know, I think 2026 still is a year of growing. And even though great strides were made last year, it would be somewhat foolish to neglect the fact that even with a 20-win turnaround, the White Sox would still be hovering around the 500 mark. So they still have plenty of work to do, and that is why Luis Robert Jr., who was only under contract for this season, of course, there was one more team option, but all in all, with the years of control and a lot of talent and potential that White Sox director of hitting Ryan Fuller and Chris Getz both really like, you can see why they finally decided to make this move. And again, the biggest thing was now the Mets were motivated to meet the White Sox asking price. When we come back, we'll let you hear from Chris Getz, as I talked about. Hey, Sox Fest Live returns to the Romova Theater, presented by Rate, Blue Moon, and Wintrust. Celebrate the start of the season with music, entertainment, and insider conversations with members of the 2026 Clubhouse. Next Saturday, January 31st. That's right, next Saturday, next week, Sox Fest. For more information, to secure your tickets, visit whitesox.com/SoxFestLive. I'm Jeff Mellor, and as I mentioned, Chris Getz met with the media earlier this week after they traded away Luis Robert Jr. We'll let you hear what he had to say coming up next, right here in your home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
White Sox fans, get access to the best seats at the best value and lock in a 2026 ticket plan today. Be here for the biggest matchups, exciting new promotions, and opening day on Thursday, April 2nd. Plus, enjoyable flexible payment plans, savings on single games, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2026. Jeff Mellor here with you on a frigid Saturday morning here in the city of Chicago, breaking down White Sox with you as we do each and every Saturday, even when it's not baseball season. Boy, just thinking about baseball has to warm you up right now because it is ridiculous outside, but that's okay. We've been through many rough Chicago winters. We will get through this one. And before you know it, we'll be talking about baseball and meaningful baseball games. Spring training is right around the corner, about 2.5 weeks away. But as, of course, we hit in the top of the show, White Sox made a major trade earlier this week when they sent Luis Robert Jr. to the Mets in exchange for Luis Angel Acuña, Ronald Acuña's little brother, and right-handed pitcher, minor leaguer Truman Pauly. They sent Robert to the Mets after there were plenty of dominoes that went down in free agency, which cleared a pathway for the White Sox and Mets to get together on a trade. Of course, Chris Getz, the man in charge for the White Sox, was the author of this deal as he got together with David Stearns. And there's been a lot of conversations surrounding Luis Robert Jr., probably for, let's call it, 18 months or so. And finally, the White Sox made a deal, and it was, as Chris Getz noted, primarily because when they had the opportunity to acquire Luis Angel Acuna, that made all the difference in the world.
It really is about being able to bring in Acuna, getting access to him. And, you know, we're talking about a player that's 5+ years of control, one of the younger, exciting players in our game, you know, hasn't really gotten a runway at the major league level. We have opportunity here, and we can provide that runway to show, you know, show off his talent and his ability and his ceiling, in which, you know, the industry has been very high on this this player for a long time. We've been tracking him for a long time. You know, when you're assessing the player, obviously you look at, you go through your scouting process, your analytic process, and you come to a decision. But to be able to bring in a young, exciting player that plays all over the diamond, you know, a strong defender, an elite defender, elite base runner, can make contact, is very strong instincts for the game. I know over in New York, talking to individuals over there, you know, they did not want to get rid of him. I know that. And that's because of how valuable he can be with the team. Now, he was on a roster that didn't really allow him to go out there and show what he could do on a regular basis, in which we're going to be able to provide that. So to get a chance at bringing in a player like that, and, you know, gain some more flexibility with moving Louis, seemed like something that we needed to strike on, and we went ahead and did that.
Where do you see Acuna in your lineup and your, you know, outfield, infield right now?
I mean, you look at the defensive projection, he grades out above average in all places, including center field. He's been playing center field in Venezuela. I think it's probably close to 15 or so games. You know, he's plus, maybe even plus in every infield position. And I would imagine in time he's going to be plus in center field if he isn't already. But the beauty of this is the versatility. We've got Chase Mydroth, Colson Montgomery that have moved around different positions. Obviously, Colson's our shortstop. Chase has played a lot of second base and shortstop. Acuna can play in all those positions. To have someone that can fill in if someone goes down, you know, if when you're looking to optimize your defense, he slides in pretty much anywhere on the field. So just to have that valuable piece is going to make, you know, Will's job a lot easier and optimizing a lineup on a regular basis. So, you know, you look at, you know, the next 5+ years with Acuna, hopefully on our club, you know, you're looking at a guy that can play in any of these positions. He's played the most at shortstop and second base and has showed elite defense there. But the ability to really move other guys around with his ability to fill in everywhere is extremely valuable for us.
Hey, Chris, had a couple follow-ups. You just mentioned flexibility, talking to agents. Is this a little bit of newfound money now you can play with a little bit?
Yes. Okay. We've got some financial flexibility now to continue to bring in talent.
The other follow-up, you mentioned runway. I mean, you're a former player. Is it your experience that sometimes breaking in to a contending team, which the Mets kind of have been over the last few years, can be pretty difficult? There's some good things. Obviously, you're surrounded by talent and winning is important, but there's probably some negatives too. Is it a developmental
situation? I think that there's some real truth to that. You look at, you know, teams that, you know, are in the playoffs, winning divisions on a regular basis, you know, you know, whether it be the Dodgers, you look at Boston, you look at New York, you look at situations, you know, in the AL Central, these younger players, it can be difficult. It's not for everyone, but there's a pressure to perform right out of the gate. And, you know, that pressure perform, you know, when you get these runways of, you know, a week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks, you need a couple months in consecutive days of playing to really get your footing at the major league level. But if you're with a club that loses three in a row and you just took an offer or you didn't have good outings on the mound and they have someone that was performing pretty well, they were hoping that they were going to get, you know, what maybe they projected with that younger player, you know, the change is made a lot quicker. Well, the player starts feeling that. They do. And then they, you know, the next opportunity that they get, they press. And then it's just kind of snowballs. You know, you see it every year. And that's why it could be so difficult to break in, where I think we've had a lot of success here, certainly pointing to last year, where we were able to give these guys a runway. It didn't matter if they had a rough game, you know, bounce back and see what happens. And they were able to gain confidence. And you know, eventually you really started seeing the production.
One more on Luis's salary. Were there permutations with the Mets or anyone else where you maybe ate some of the salary to increase the prospect return? How were those conversations, or is it straight?
Okay. We played around with different ideas. You know, we did. There was different concepts that were out there, but all things being equal, it really came down to the player return. Do we like where this is at? And then there was a bonus, of course, with some financial flexibility.
Hey, Chris, you know, it sounds like the way you're talking about Luis Angel, that you kind of intention of running him out there every day, or at least something close to that. Where do you kind of see his offensive projection if he gets that type of runway? Is because he's someone who, you know, has big time bat speed. Obviously, we've seen, you know, the burst of power in Venezuela pretty recently, but hasn't necessarily had a ton of in-game, you know, home run production, at least in the majors. What do you kind of see the potential if you kind of give him, you know, 500, 600 plate appearances in a year?
Well, it starts with some swing adjustments that he has been working on. I know at the end of the year in New York, he and the coaches and their head of hitting, they were working on, you know, some swing adjustments, some swing changes that allowed him to get the ball in the air a little bit more because he had heavy ground ball tendencies. And they started to see those strides, and then he's been able to take that into Winter League in Venezuela. Now, that's not always an automatic that it's going to translate. I think we can all acknowledge that. However, there are some indicators that he is, you know, he's headed in the right direction. And, you know, once again, you put that on top of the fact that he's going to come to a club where we can give him those consistent at-bats to test and get early feedback on those adjustments. And if he needs to make more, you continue, you know, you rinse and repeat. That's the beauty of our situation here. You know, most of his value right now is certainly the defense, the elite base running. He's got contact ability. He's shown the ability to hit. It's just a matter of getting the ball, hitting more line drives. He's got some power. We know that can be dangerous for some, but really find that balance for his overall offensive production. You know, our marker oftentimes is, you know, does this player have a pathway to at least become a two-win player? And, you know, we feel like Acuña, based on, you know, the defense and the base running, and with this offensive skill set, if we can increase his offensive skill set, we've got a guy that can go two wins or more.
Do you see any benefit? I mean, obviously you've been operating with it for the last couple of years of not having the specter of Robert trade rumors hanging over, you know, both him, Luis, for him personally, or even just kind of the team of kind of building something, but also having this, you know, prominent guy who's seemingly maybe not a part of the long-term picture. Does handling this in the offseason, do you see some benefit to that?
I think so. We can just go out there and as a team and, you know, focus on getting better and winning baseball games. You know, I can't speak for every player and how they, you know, manage rumors that are swirling or any sort of, you know, and how they internalize that. That's everyone kind of deals with that differently. But I think if you ask most players, you know, 95% of the time, they would like to know where they're going to be for a season. And in Robert's case, you know, he now could put that behind him and go and play in New York.
And you mentioned being very active. Are there, you know, you mentioned outfield. Are there specific areas that you're kind of targeting over this final month for camp breaks as far as what your priorities are for adding?
All areas. You know, I know, you know, when you move on from a Louis Robert, you know, there's this assumption that, you know, a certain position needs to be filled, but it's increasing talent on the team to help us win ball games. That could come in starting pitching, relievers, you know, balancing right-handed versus left-handed. So we're very open-minded and, you know, excited to get to work and being creative and bringing in that talent.
Hey, Chris, had you had many discussions with the Mets in the past about Luis and just how quickly did this move come about?
Yeah, they've had interest in Luis for a while. They have. You know, I would say, you know, yesterday morning is when they felt like they were at a decision point. I don't know what else they were working on. You know, I've got a good relationship with Dave and Searns, and, you know, when you sense urgency and you know something's real, you usually want to engage on it. So, yeah, yesterday morning it picked up. Over the weekend, we had some discussions as well. You know, I know they've been active in the free agent market and been able to convert on some moves, and, you know, perhaps they've missed on some players as well. You never know what's going to affect the market. But this weekend is when, you know, they at least have connected with us. And then yesterday morning, I felt like it was about to get pretty serious.
And if you can, just sort of how would you kind of sum up Luis Robert's 6 years or more with the White Sox organization?
You know, obviously the talent is real. You know, unfortunately, you know, he hasn't had, you know, the consistency that he had hoped or we had hoped. You know, I know that, you know, he cares about the game deeply. He wants to play well. It's a challenging game. I know injuries have really held him back. You know, if you can rewind the clock and you look at his, you know, 23 and prior seasons, yeah, they were really impactful for this organization. And he deserves a lot of credit for doing that. The last couple of years, it just hasn't been there. And we felt like it was time to make this move, turn the page, and continue this build forward.
Hey, Chris, what stood out to you guys about Truman Pauly and how much of that assessment evaluation goes back to really the draft process, just given his limited sample in the minors last season?
You know, any opportunity to bring in a Harvard kid, I think, you know, add some intellectual firepower to an organization. But, you know, on the field, you know, he you look at the stuff, you know, the ability to spin the baseball, you know, just allows us to really hone in on his development and his arsenal to tap into some real upside. So it's still a work in progress. You know, they paid him a fair amount of money with the round that he was taken in. He's a guy that we're familiar with, certainly been tracking him for a while. Our R&D group was really high on him, and our scouts were there to support it as well. So we felt like it was a nice addition. There were, you know, a pool of players we were discussing, and you know, we decided to go with him.
Hey, Chris, we asked you about Braden at the winter meetings. We asked you, you know, at the end of last season, we've asked you a lot about Braden. How does he kind of, in your kind of big board on the wall there in your office, how does he kind of fit into 26 plans in particular?
You know, with players like Braden, you know, obviously a super talented, high engine type athlete that can play all three outfield spots. He's got power from both sides. He's only continuing to get better. He's shown that, you know, once he got up to AA and finished in the AFL, it was really, really trending in a good direction. You know, coming into spring training, I want him to come in and compete for a spot. I do think that at some point he could come into the mix. You know, so we're open-minded. We always are with young players. You know, but I just want him to go out there and focus, be the best player he can be, because it's really about the long term for Braden Montgomery and the White Sox. It's not about Braden Montgomery making the opening day roster.
So there you go. That was Chris Getz early Wednesday morning reacting to the White Sox trading Luis Robert Jr. And of course, you heard the final question there from Scott Merkin regarding Braden Montgomery, who is no doubt going to have a little bit more runway, or at least an opportunity. There should be some outfield at-bats available. Although, as you heard from Chris Getz there, they're going to allow Braden Montgomery to develop at his timeline, and they will not rush him. That obviously is prudent, but based on what we saw last year, don't count out seeing Braden Montgomery playing baseball at 35th and Shields later this season, and very possibly earlier than some might expect, because he really did a great job in his first professional season with the Chicago White Sox last year. Of course, one of the key pieces that the White Sox got back in that Garrett Crochet trade. I'm Jeff Meller, hanging out with you here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, we have to celebrate the life, as we got word last week Saturday afternoon, right after we got off the air, shortly after we got off the air, that the White Sox had lost a legend, Wilbur Wood, White Sox pitcher, famous lefty knuckleballer, and some of his former teammates, Steve Stone and Jim Kotz, took some time to remember their former teammate. We'll share some of those thoughts with you coming up next, right here on your home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000.
Follow Chicago's home for sports on Twitter at ESPN 1000.
Welcome to White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000. 1000.
Sox fans, sign up to become a White Sox insider and get special offers, single game ticket presales, and other exciting Sox content delivered free to your inbox. Visit WhiteSox.com/insider today. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly. And as I mentioned as we were heading to break, got some sad news last week when we found out that White Sox legend Wilbur Wood had passed away on Saturday at the age of 84. And, of course, a couple of former teammates of his were more than happy to share some stories earlier this week, remembering their good times as his former teammate. But before I get to those real quick, for those of you who are a little bit younger, or maybe you're just my age and you didn't have the opportunity to see Wilbur Wood pitch, but perhaps you have, as a White Sox fan, seen his name in White Sox record books. You've seen him amongst the team leaders in lots of key statistical categories. And to give you a little bit of background before I let Steve Stone and Jim Kotz give you much more details than I could, it's worth noting that Wilbur Wood came to the White Sox in 1967 primarily as a reliever until 1971, when he was thrust into the rotation, into the White Sox rotation, as a left-handed knuckleballer. And for the next five seasons, primarily due to before he took a line drive off of his leg in 1976, but the five seasons prior to that, the statistics are absolutely eye-popping. And you may look back at baseball stats and go, okay, sure, I know that guys would log a lot of innings, but over a five-year stretch from 1971 to 1975, Wilbur Wood started 224 games for the White Sox. That's right. In five seasons, Wilbur Wood started 224 games. That's an average of 45 starts per season. Again, as a lefty knuckleballer, he obviously could avoid the wear and tear. He also eclipsed 1,681 innings while those five seasons took place. That's an average of 336 innings per year by Wilbur Wood. Of course, because he logged lots of innings, he also recorded lots of decisions. Wilbur Wood averaged a record of 21-17 over those five seasons as a member of the White Sox. He accumulated a 106-89 record during that time. And probably, if you look at it, his best season was in 1971, that first year as a starter, when he accumulated an 11.7 wins above replacement with a 1.91 ERA. That's just ridiculous. In 334 innings pitched, struck out 210, of course, as a knuckleballer. He finished third in Cy Young voting that year, ninth in MVP voting. And then the next season, Wilbur Wood would outdo himself by pitching 376 innings, coming 24 innings shy of 400. Absolutely remarkable. Wilbur Wood, the lefty knuckleballer who took the ball virtually every third day as a member of the White Sox for about a five-year period, and a man who was a member of the White Sox rotation for Wilbur Wood's final two seasons in 1977 and 1978, is, of course, a man you probably know very well. That is Steve Stone. Steve Stone talked earlier this week about his former teammate, Wilbur Wood.
Oh, I think Wilbur was a really nice guy. He was very funny, and he was just one of those guys that was an unassuming star. I mean, when you look at some of the numbers, you get a guy that started 48 games in a season. He was one of those guys that just handed him the baseball. He kept on pitching, whether it was a doubleheader or whether he had to pitch with the day's rest or whatever the case may be. And Wilbur facilitated for me because of his presence. I actually pitched in a three-man pitching rotation. It was Wilbur, Stan Bonson, and me. So every third day, I was getting the baseball because they wanted to get Wilbur as many starts as they possibly could because he could pitch forever, as evidenced by pitching a doubleheader, getting decisions in both games, and all of those things that he did. But because there wasn't a whole lot of strain on his arm because of the knuckleball, he was able to just keep going out there. So that meant that there was two other guinea pigs that had to go out there with 2 days rest and pitch in the same rotation. And from June 2nd on that year, I was one of those guys. So I think I started my first game for the White Sox that year because with three-man rotation, I was the fourth starter, but they stuck me in the bullpen. So I remember getting my first start on June 2nd and throwing 174 innings, I believe, that year. So there was a lot of starts condensed in a very, very short period of time.
What did you learn from just watching him work on a day in and day out basis?
Well, Wilbur used to say to me, I've got the best curve. He used to say that he had the best curveball on the team. And I said, well, why don't you throw it? He said, no, thanks. I'll stick with the knuckleball. So what I learned was whatever you had as your best pitch, especially if you had one that was fairly close to unhittable when it was executed successfully, go with that pitch. And Wilbur, who was a marginal pitcher, developed the knuckleball. And even more importantly than that, he developed the ability to get it over the plate, which is something a lot of people can throw the knuckleball. They just can't get it over the plate consistently. Wilbur could do that. And so he was, in those days, well, he would be today, if you could find one, one of your more valuable pitchers, because he ate up so many innings that, you know, would have had to go to somebody else. And eventually, that somebody else would have probably given way to the bullpen. Wilbur could throw complete games. He could throw forever. And again, a very valuable man to have on a team, but there weren't a whole lot of Wilbers around. I mean, look, everybody tried to throw it. There's a whole lot of guys. And what I found over the course of my career was that infielders had better knuckleballs than anybody else. You'd play catch with an infielder. He'd show you these knuckleballs that were absolutely unhittable. Now, he decided, you know, he didn't want to go to the mound and make a living throwing knuckleballs, but it remains a very difficult pitch to master. If more guys could master it, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about bringing back a knuckleballer to teach a whole generation of guys, and maybe you get one or two that could actually do it. But I think it would be a phenomenal weapon. Wilbur showed just what a great weapon it could be, and how you could probably get an extra pitcher on your staff if you carried a guy that could pitch as many innings and as many starts and do all the things that Wilbur could do. But then again, you know, if everybody could do it, then everybody would be doing it, because nobody can hit that pitch, and yet they can't. So Wilbur made it into an art form.
You know, I know you were talking about the knuckleball, and, you know, his arm could bounce back. But just in general, for a pitcher, when you're throwing 380 and 370 and 359 innings, What kind of physical toll does it take on you year to year?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at Wilbur, he didn't exactly look like Michael Jordan body type wise. So I think that the knuckleball took all kinds of strain off your body. I mean, it's a pitch that you don't really throw; you actually push out when you deliver it, and it takes an incredible amount of strain on your body. So it wasn't like everybody could take a look at Wilbur, who was a guy who might have been a touch overweight, and want to emulate that, because everybody would have loved to have done it. There wasn't any lessons to be learned, because very few people, if any, could do it. I mean, you know, you had Wakefield, you had Ken Diatti, you had the Negro brothers. I mean, you know, Hoyt Wilhelm. There's been a few guys over the years that have been able to master it. But I think, you know, when we talk about all the guys that have ascended that hill and pitched in Major League Baseball, and you look at all of them and realize how very few guys could master that knuckleball, you could want to be like Wilbur Wood, only, you know, your chances were very slim. So, and also, you know, when you look at it, it seems like most of the knuckleballers were right-handed, and Wilbur was not. Wilbur was left-handed. So that also was kind of against the grain, but he was able to make it work.
Steve, what type of player and teammate was he?
He was a terrific teammate. I really liked Wilbur. I thought he was a really good guy. One of the more unassuming stars of the game of baseball that you'll ever meet in your life. I mean, he could have very well been a mechanic brought in to fix your dishwasher or your sink or something else. You know, if you saw Wilbur with a little sack on his shoulder or something along those lines, maybe a toolbox, you'd think, oh yeah, he's coming over to fix something for me. But then you got him in a major league ballpark and put him on that mound, and he was the guy who would stay out there as long as it took. So I liked him. I thought he was a pretty good teammate, and again, one of the more unassuming guys you'd ever met in your life. You know, a lot of people say that you're one way when you come in the game, and if you achieve any stardom, all of a sudden you start to assume that the life revolves around me syndrome that happens to some professional athletes. Wilbur was the antithesis of that guy. He was just a plain old guy that came in and had this ability to throw a knuckleball, obviously, you know, because he obviously got to where he was allowed to throw a knuckleball in the major leagues by throwing regular pitches along the way, and certainly then suddenly realized that he had just adequate stuff, but the knuckleball made him special.
That was Steve Stone, of course, and in addition to Stoney talking about Wilbur Wood, the White Sox also made Hall of Famer Jim Cotts, the lefty starting pitcher who spent three seasons with the White Sox between 1973 and 1975 in that rotation with Wilbur Wood. That was, of course, those 3 years were probably the best three seasons that Wilbur Wood pitched. The Hall of Famer Jim Cott talked fondly about his teammate Wilbur Wood.
I see Wilbur on a couple of different levels as a teammate. You know, it was amazing the years he had. I was just there with him two and a fraction, but the 4 years he had from like 72 to 75, if he didn't get hit in the kneecap, he might have compiled some pretty stats that, of course, will never be reached. And a lot of them, as it stands, won't be. You talk about starting over 40 games 4 years in a row and 20 games. Now, we got a lot of decisions in those days because you stayed in the game with the DH later. So, I mean, Wilbur was like 20 and 19, but, you know, he went to the post every 3 or 4 days. So, and I admired the way Chuck handled him. You know, Chuck would, before the days of analytics and stuff, if Wilbur went through the batting order three times, he didn't pitch a lot of shutouts, but we had Goose and Jerry Forster in the bullpen. So both of us knew if we had the lead after seven innings, why we had a pretty good chance to win the game. And as a person, Wilbur and I would play a lot of catch on the sidelines. And he would throw his knuckleball, and I would try to catch it. And his goal was to see if he could hit me, so I didn't catch it. And then he showed me how to throw the knuckleball. I only used it a couple times. And then a little human interest thing, you didn't have post-game spreads in the clubhouse in those days, so there was a little Mexican restaurant across the street from Comiskey, and we'd get one of the clubhouse guys occasionally to go over, get us a burrito, and about the fifth inning it would be there. So when I would find out where Wilbur's was, I would hide his in a locker under a towel so he'd have to play hide and seek to get it. So we had a little game like that going on. So those were some of the simple things we did in those days before iPads and analytics. But he was just a wonderful teammate.
Hey, Jim, it's Lamont Pope from the Chicago Tribune. Just, yeah, what type of example did Wilbur set with that durability and that on a day in and day out basis?
Well, first of all, he was unique in that he was a knuckleball pitcher. You couldn't ask Bart Johnson to do that. I did it because I was not an overpowering pitcher. You couldn't have asked Nolan Ryan to do that, but it fit in well with Wilbur because, you know, it kept him sharp. Some days he'd pitch with 2 days rest. We both did. And I don't think he would set an example for the other pitchers. It was just that with his style, with the knuckleball, I think other knuckleball pitchers could have done that because it was so, as he said in some of his quotes, there was no stress on his arm, like pitchers who threw a splitter or a slider or a curveball. So it was very easy for him. He probably could have pitched every day, you know, other than his, you know, his legs would give out a little bit. But he was not the kind of guy that other pitchers could look at and say, well, I want to do that, because they weren't knuckleball pitchers.
What kind of impact did Wilbur have for the rest of the team, just knowing that he was going to be that durable and reliable and available all the time as well?
Well, I think it made it easier for Chuck Tanner because we had, we went with three or four starters. I mean, Wilbur and I, and then Claude Osteen one year. I think Wilbur and I started 50% of the games in 2 years' time there. And Wilbur, of course, on the heavy side of that, going 43 to 49 times. So I think it made Chuck's job easier because Wilbur never had any arm problems. He didn't have to worry about putting them on the disabled list with that knuckleball. So it gave him a lot of comfort in setting up the rotation. And then as Wilbur began to have success, I think the influence he had on the guys playing behind him is they knew that they were probably going to get some action because Wilbur was not a strikeout pitcher like a Nolan Ryan. And so he was just a very dependable guy that the White Sox can look forward to going out there every three or four days and giving up probably 6 to 7 innings. Those 4 years he had from a durability standpoint were just incredible. That's 73 through 75. As I mentioned in a previous question, I think that getting hit by LaFleur's line drive, getting hit in the kneecap, that kept him from having a few more really effective years.
So there you go, Jim Cott, the Hall of Famer and rotation mate of Wilbur Wood, who we found out passed away last Saturday, January 17th. Wilbur Wood was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts on October 22nd, 1941. Again, died on January 17th, 2026 at the age of 84 as Hall of Famer Jim Cott and White Sox legend and broadcaster Steve Stone took some time out earlier this week to remember their teammates. Rest in peace, Wilbur, the big lefty knuckler who took the mound for so many innings in the 70s. A no doubts fan favorite for plenty of White Sox fans who grew up during the 70s. Or if you were just alive to see it, no doubt Wilbur Wood left a indelible impression on White Sox fans as a lefty workhorse starter and three-time All-Star. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. When we come back to wrap it up, a quick word on a couple of new members or soon-to-be new members of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. When we come back right here on ESPN 1000.
We are talking White Sox.
This is White Sox Weekly.
If you missed the show, we put the podcast up on the ESPN Chicago app. So listen on your time.
White Sox Weekly. ESPN Chicago. Chicago's home for sports.
Celebrate your special occasion in 2026 with a White Sox party area. Reserve your group outing today to get access to the best spaces and the top matchups like opening day on April 2nd, plus other big matchups against the Cubs, Dodgers, and Yankees. For more information, visit whitesox.com/groups or call 312-674-1000. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly as we wrap up this edition. Of course, the Luis Robert Jr. was traded for Luis Angel Acuna and Truman Pauly edition. That was the biggest, of course, time that we spent today here on White Sox Weekly, as you heard from Chris Getz. And, of course, we remembered White Sox legend Wilbur Wood as Steve Stone and Jim Cott both shared their thoughts on their former teammates in the 70s and a White Sox legend. That's going to do it for this edition. As always, I want to say thank you to the executive producer of White Sox Baseball, Brendan Riley. We'll do it again next week. And remember, Sox Fest coming your way next Saturday. So we are a week away from Sox Fest at the Remova Theater. So go ahead and plan accordingly. We'll see you out there next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jeff Meller right here in your home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000.
Yeah. This is Tyler and Shay. Tyler and Shay.
I know you're going to dig this.
On Chicago's home for sports. ESPN Chicago. Always streaming on the ESPN.